It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, we are your public radio station, broadcasting from beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 30 degrees up here on Signal Hill, 27 degrees out at the airport, where they are recording wind speeds from the northwest at 14, gusting to 28. They're calling for sunny skies for the rest of the day, with a steady temperature around 23. Earlier, they were calling for the temperatures to drop until 5 p.m. today. West winds to 15. For tonight, those temperatures are expected to rise until they reach 30 degrees by 3 a.m. tonight. And we're going to get some snow tonight. 100% chance of it. New snow accumulation of up to 4 inches overnight tonight. Coming up on the Midday Report, local cases of COVID continue to dip. Kodiak's Regional Tribal Health Organization is hosting some mental health first aid classes this month. And Brent Sass has won the Quest 350. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Ukraine will stage several military drills throughout the country in the coming days to prepare for a possible Russian invasion. NPR's Kat Lunsdorf is in Kyiv. She says the drills will happen as Russia also plans military exercises in neighboring Belarus.
In a television interview, Ukraine's defense minister announced that the drills will run for 10 days starting on the 10th of this month, the exact dates that Russia has said it will hold military drills in Belarus. The Kremlin says Russia has been building up its military presence in Ukraine's northern neighbor specifically for these drills, but many are skeptical of that as the international community worries of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russia has promised its troops will leave after the planned military exercises are complete. In the meantime, NATO has warned that it will increase its military presence in the Baltic states and Poland in case that doesn't happen. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Kyiv.
Second gentleman Doug Emhoff was whisked away by Secret Service agents today because of an apparent bomb threat. At the time, Vice President Kamala Harris's husband was attending an event at Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. that was commemorating Black History Month. A spokesperson says Emhoff is safe. Teachers and students were also evacuated. A New York couple has been arrested and charged with allegedly laundering billions of dollars worth of cryptocurrency stolen in the 2016 hack of a virtual currency exchange. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports the government also seized more than $3.6 billion in stolen Bitcoin.
Federal agents arrested Ilya Lichtenstein and Heather Morgan in Manhattan on money laundering and conspiracy charges. Prosecutors say the couple conspired to launder nearly 120,000 Bitcoin stolen by hackers from the Bitfinex exchange in 2016. That Bitcoin was worth roughly $71 million at the time of the hack, but has since soared in value to more than $4.5 billion. Officials say the stolen funds were moved through complex transactions and across digital platforms in an effort to hide the money. But they say investigators managed to trace the funds back to Lichtenstein and Morgan. Officials say the government seizure of $3.6 billion is the department's largest ever and shows that cryptocurrency is not a safe haven for criminals. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
President Biden's announced that Australia-based Tritium, which makes chargers for electric vehicles, will build a factory in Tennessee.
Today's announcement is part of the drumbeat of jobs resurgence, like anything, more than anything we've seen before.
The announcement, part of Biden's broader infrastructure law that passed last year with bipartisan support. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closes up 371 points, or more than 1%, ending the day at 35,462. It's NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
Local cases of COVID-19 have continued to dip. Kodiak's Emergency Operations Center reported 26 new cases of the virus since its last update on Friday. There are now 151 cases currently classified as active locally. The EOC's latest data reports no current hospitalizations from COVID. Kodiak's regional tribal health organization is hosting two mental health first aid classes this month. The courses are organized by the Kodiak Area Native Association and are part of a nationwide program. As KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, it's the first time the class has been open and free to the public in Kodiak.
Even before the pandemic, accessing mental health services was a challenge on Kodiak Island. That's according to Kodiak's two most recent community health needs assessments published by Providence Medical Center in 2016 and 2019. 20% of survey respondents said they had needed mental health services in the last year, but over a third of them weren't able to access care. Barriers to treatment included cost, not being able to get an appointment, and stigma. And local health clinics said they had been having trouble recruiting and retaining psychiatrists. In fact,
the number one need the community identified was behavioral health services, which includes mental health services.
Molly Miller is a prevention specialist for CANA. She's also teaching the class alongside staff from the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center. She says the pandemic has highlighted the lack of mental health resources in rural communities, and it's also gotten people talking more about the issue.
The focus of the program is, one, to decrease stigma around mental health, and so to kind of make people more comfortable with having conversations about mental health. And the second part is to give people tools on how to listen and how to assist those who are in need or may be experiencing a mental health challenge.
CANA offered youth mental health first aid classes last year, but this is the first time coursework will be aimed at adults. Classes are free and encompass 8 hours of in-person instruction, with a couple hours of online work ahead of time. Participants receive a certificate as a mental health first aider once they finish the class. That doesn't mean they're qualified to make a diagnosis, but it can be helpful to spot someone in crisis or someone that just needs to feel heard. Other organizations like Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Anchorage have also offered mental health first aid programs for youth and adults. Miller says there's a growing statewide interest in the classes, especially given how accessible they can be virtually. She says that teams of local mental health first aiders in Kodiak won't replace the need for more clinicians and services on the island, but they might help bridge the gap. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
CANA's first mental health class on Thursday, February 17th at the CANA Wellness Center is already full, but there are still spaces available in the Tuesday, February 22nd class in the Koniag Conference Room. CANA's website is canahealthcare.org. Brent Sass cruised across the Fairbanks finish line earlier this morning to win the Yukon Quest 350. Sass and his 14 dogs were all alone in the last 40 miles of trail from the last checkpoint at Pleasant Valley to the finish line, having built a substantial lead over second-placed musher Matt Hall. Sass credits his dogs' power, including on the run over the race's biggest challenge, 3,700-foot Eagle Summit.
Going up, it was pretty nice, and dogs did an excellent job. I ran a little ways, and once we got over the super steep part, I got to sit on the back of the sled, and the dogs just marched right up. So it was a good workout still, but the dogs are super strong.
Matt Hall is expected in before noon today. Behind him are Deke Nakaboran of Fairbanks and Healy's Jennifer Labar. The 350's three other starters, Cody Straith, Rob Cook, and Misho Willis, scratched earlier in the race. All 11 mushers in the Quest 200 have completed their race in Central. The 30-year-old Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, was passed to give tribes a legal avenue for the return of ancestral remains and some cultural objects. But many remains and objects remain in storage and collections of federal agencies and museums. As KNBA's Trip J. Krause reports, several agency and tribal officers spoke to a Senate committee about where the law falls short.
During a federal hearing on a 30-year-old law designed to give indigenous tribes a path toward getting cultural items and ancestral remains back, lawmakers learned how they could make the law better. Rosita Worrell has a PhD in anthropology and served on a National NAGPRA Review Committee for 12 years. She told a U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs that tribes spend a lot of time trying to work their way through this process, and it doesn't always pay off.
Tribes go to a great deal of efforts and expense to bring the case before the committee, a committee comprised of scientists, museum professionals, and tribal members, without any guarantee that the committee's finding will be acted upon. Four, describe a discrete category of funding to support disputes. And then increase NAGPRA funding for tribes and museums. I know that this is a concern.
Federally recognized tribes in the lower 48 can initiate claims, and for about 20 years, Alaska Native corporations were eligible as well. But that changed when the National Park Service declared them ineligible. Alaska's tribal organizations, management, and Alaska Native corporations create complicated bureaucracy for indigenous communities looking to return sacred objects.
And in our region, repatriation claims came to all but a stop, except for our one regional tribe. So it's been a loss for us that we have not been able to continue this important work of seeking the returns of our sacred objects and our ancestors.
Worrell says Alaska Native corporations should be eligible to initiate repatriation claims. Other people who testified encouraged shifting oversight of NAGPRA to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Currently, much of the work is handled by the Interior Department's National Park Service. Joy Beasley is the Associate Director of Cultural Resources, Partnership, and Sciences at the Interior Department.
The Department of the Interior is aware of the inconsistencies with the way that the law is interpreted and applied across the United States, including among federal agencies. And we believe that the proposed regulatory changes will go a long ways towards clarifying the roles and responsibilities of federal agencies, as well as clarifying the timelines and the other requirements. So we're certainly aware of the issue, and we hope that the proposed regulations will address some of those challenges.
The Interior Department hired a full-time employee to investigate NAGPRA claims and violations of the law in late January. In addition to better oversight, some federal officials say there should be more funding available. From 1990 to 2020, about $50 million have been awarded to help with repatriation efforts. Anna Maria Ortiz is the Director of Natural Resources and Environment at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. That office made several recommendations to improve NAGPRA in 2010.
One of our recommendations was that agencies really figure out what they needed to do to implement the act properly and develop timelines for doing so.
Ortiz said the office got estimates from some federal departments that it could take decades and millions of dollars to go through all of their collections and figure out what they have that could be given back to tribes.
And in many cases, agencies estimated that it would cost hundreds of thousands or even millions more than they currently had appropriated to implement the act effectively.
One of the key contested points of the recommended changes to NAGPRA is how long it takes to consult with tribes after an artifact or remains are discovered. Worrell says affected tribes should be contacted immediately, within 3 days, and not later after an agency performs its own inquiries and studies.
Consulting and informing tribal members immediately upon the discovery of any kind of human remains, that must remain in place. And I am concerned that there may be some changes in the procedures, the proposed rules that may alter that. We need to make sure that that tribes are there right away and that we have a say in any kind of inadvertent discoveries.
In addition to the revisions to NAGPRA under consideration, another bill would make it illegal to export Native cultural items without proper authorization. The Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act is currently in the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. In Anchorage, I'm Trip J. Krause.
New rules for first-time commercial vehicle drivers took effect in Alaska on Monday. The new regulations call for more thorough instruction for anyone seeking a new Class B license or higher. As KHNS's Mike Swayze reports, the costs for most tour companies and tourist towns won't be as high as some had feared. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration's new rules for entry-level commercial drivers will require more formalized training for anyone seeking to operate a vehicle over 26,000 pounds. In Skagway, small tour companies rely on hiring and training new tour guides from season to season. Luckily, for most Skagway businesses, their vehicles don't exceed that weight limit and won't require the more extensive training. Chris Lisenby from Alaska Driving Academy in Soldotna says his entry-level driver training program made the switch to the new curriculum when the administration first announced it would be increasing standards a few years ago.
The whole purpose for the ELDT mandate was to put more educated, trained drivers out on the road. Too many people were going and getting the quickie license, get my license, get out there and drive, and it was bad for the industry. The motor carriers didn't like it because they were getting drivers that didn't know anything about the industry and their skills were bare minimum. And it's not safe for the motoring public. You know, just because you have your license doesn't mean that you really have a full idea of how that vehicle operates in different conditions.
Greg Clem owns Klondike Tours and will begin operating Skagway's shuttle service, SmartBus, in April. He says all of his vehicles are under the weight limit, but there are some changes he'll have to make to train new Class C drivers that can drive his airport shuttle-sized buses. First, he'll have to become a licensed instructor. In order to do that, you must have had the same level of license with all applicable endorsements for at least 2 years. Then you fill out the application and can teach the curriculum.
It's a lot of paperwork, but it's all free. Assuming I am doing the training, they would come to me first. According to the laws, I have to do the passenger endorsement. According to reality, I would have trained them on everything.
Once Clem submits all of his paperwork, he'll be registered on a national database of licensed instructors. He can choose to teach anyone looking for a Class C license with a passenger endorsement, or he can choose to only teach people at his company. For now, in order to get fully licensed to drive tours in Skagway, new drivers will have to take a bus to Juneau to complete their testing. Clem says that'll cost about $600 to put one of his smaller buses on the ferry and another $200 or so in fees. New school bus drivers will need to learn from a licensed instructor found on the National Registry and complete the S endorsement. For new drivers looking to get into driving large vehicles with air brakes or big rigs, the training is more intense.
If you're a Class A or B, you have to go do that from a trainer that has that credential.
Courses at training schools in Alaska vary in length from 5 days to several weeks. Sarah Douthit from Kenai Peninsula Driving School says her school has students complete a portion of their learning online before in-person instruction begins at the school.
Whether you go to a big school for 6 months or whether you come here for 1 week behind the wheel and 1 week of online learning, as long as those requirements are met by your program, then you can get into a CDL.
The cost of courses at training schools in Alaska varies from a little over $5,000 to over $7,000, and most are located near large population centers. For now, there is no road course or CDL examiner available in Skagway, which is why prospective drivers will have to travel to Juneau. But that could change, according to DMV officials. Reporting from Skagway, I'm Mike Swayze.
As the old adage goes, one man's trash is another man's treasure. At the Central Peninsula Landfill in Soldotna, the Kenai Peninsula Borough and Homer Electric Association are hoping to turn trash into treasure by capturing harmful methane gas and turning it into usable fuel. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
The Borough and HEA have been talking about implementing the Soldotna Landfill Gas Project for years. Landfills across the U.S. are putting together similar programs to cut costs and comply with environmental regulations. Last month, HEA took its largest step on the project when it submitted a request for grant funding for the project's design from the Alaska Energy Authority. David Thomas is Director of Strategic Services for the utility. He says the project will save the borough money.
There's not a regulatory requirement yet to do this, but there are economic savings to be achieved by utilizing an unused resource.
At the center of the plan is methane, a greenhouse gas that's much more harmful to the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Landfills like the Central Peninsula Landfill are some of the biggest contributors of human-related methane emissions in the U.S. As it stands, the methane at the Soldotna Landfill is lost in the air. HEA's project would capture that methane, burn it, and generate additional electricity for its grid, about 1.6 megawatts, or about 3% of the total load. The project would also power the landfill's leachate evaporator. Leachate is the liquid that results when snow or rain seeps through trash. If left alone, it can also get into the ground. For years, the borough's been dealing with its leachate by turning it into water vapor, using an evaporator that runs on natural gas. The methane plant would create heat that could be used to power that evaporator. That way, Thomas says, the borough would be generating gas on site rather than buying it from NSTAR.
There's potentially over $1 million a year savings to go this route than to continue on the current path.
Plus, the project would capture the harmful methane that the landfill garbage is now leaking. Thomas says while Central Peninsula Landfill isn't yet mandated to deal with its methane emissions, it is a requirement for larger facilities. Anchorage is already capturing its landfill methane, delivering landfill gas to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, where it's converted to electricity and used to partly power the base. The grant application HEA submitted January 18th would fund a detailed design of a potential plant. While HEA has done preliminary design planning to sketch out the economics of the project, it hasn't come up with a full schematic that outlines aspects like pipe size and foundation details. Thomas says it needs that first before it can issue a request for proposals and hand over a plan to a contractor. The project in total is estimated to cost over $12 million. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Insight Daily Radio.
The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic, is a groundbreaking new book that examines the phenomenon of mass shootings in America and an urgent call to implement evidence-based strategies to stop these tragedies. Frustrated by reactionary policy conversations, the authors, Special Investigator and Psychologist Jill Peterson and Sociologist James Densley, built the Violence Project, the first comprehensive database of mass shooters to establish the root causes of mass shootings and figure out how to stop them. We spoke with them about this most important book.
When I was working with people on death row in New York, we had this saying, which was the worse the crime, the worse the story. And it was just always true that if you were looking at a horrific crime, you were always going to uncover some horrific story. And so I had a hunch when we went into this research that mass shooters were going to have pretty extensive histories of trauma. And it was so clear so quickly, each person we talked to, and these were really significant trauma histories.
This might be domestic violence in the home. It might be a parental suicide. It might be physical or sexual abuse in the home. But these were terrible traumatic events that then were never really dealt with. They never went to therapy. They never got the support that they needed. They never got the intervention that was necessary. And then when you pile on other stresses throughout the life, it created a sort of foundation upon which the violence that followed was built upon.
That's Special Investigator and Psychologist Jill Peterson and Sociologist James Densley, the authors of The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic, which has just been released.
Insight Daily Radio.
A housing needs assessment survey is coming soon to Kodiak. Help your community by participating in the survey, which may come by mail or a phone call. Responses are anonymous and will be incorporated into a housing needs assessment document that will be available to the public. Those who complete the survey will be entered in a prize drawing happening each week in February. This message is sponsored by Kodiak Island Housing Authority.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 8th day of February, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 8:56. It will set again at 5:52. That will give us 8 hours and 56 minutes of glorious daylight. Tomorrow, 9 hours. That's a gain of 4 minutes and 40 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was -2, set in 1984 and 91. Our record high was 53, set in 1982. Currently 26 degrees out at the airport, and that temperature has been dropping steadily all day. We're looking for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, with temperatures dropping to 23, west wind to 10. For tonight, temperatures will be rising again. They'll get to 30 by 3 a.m. tonight. That's going to bring us some snow, possibility of up to 4 inches of it tonight. Also look for areas of blowing snow once that stuff starts to pile up, because we're going to have southeast winds to 10, turning to the northwest to 20 and coming up to 25 tonight. For tomorrow, chance of snow before noon, then isolated snow showers after 3 p.m. with areas of blowing snow before 9 a.m. Cloudy skies tomorrow will gradually become mostly sunny, the temperature falling to 19 degrees tomorrow by 5 p.m. We have a low tide coming up here on the east side at 1:33 this afternoon, about an hour. That will be a 2-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 7:35 p.m. of 5 feet, another low tide after midnight at 12:43 a.m., a 3.2-foot tide, and our morning high tide for the east side will occur at 7:29 a.m. and be 7.7 feet. Over on the west side, you have a low tide coming up at 1:59 p.m., call it 2 o'clock. That will be 3.2 feet in Larsen Bay. Your next high tide will be at 7:51 p.m. and be 8.9 feet, followed by a low tide at 1:21 a.m., of 5.1 feet, and your morning low tide on the west side will happen at 7:54 a.m. and be 11.9 feet in Larsen Bay. Well, the Weather Service marine weather site is broken. It hasn't refreshed today. They were calling for west winds to 30 today and seas to 17 feet on our east side, Marmot Island to Sitkanak. Over on the west side in the Shelikof Strait, they were calling for a gale warning through today with west winds to 35 knots and seas to 11 feet, and freezing spray today in the Shelikof with heavy freezing spray a possibility for tonight. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session on Tuesday, February 8th, that is tonight. The meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. tonight. They will also be holding their regular meeting at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday. Elected officials will be attending virtually and or in person for both meetings. Public participation is virtual only. Public members are encouraged to tune in right here at KMXT on 100.1 FM. The call-in for public comments is 486-8610. A pause will be made to allow those to call in to get in the queue. Any written public comments can be submitted to the mayor and council members directly or to the clerk's office at clerks@city.kodiak.ak.us to disseminate. Or you can go to the City of Kodiak's website, where you can also find the web streaming link and meeting packets. Any more questions you might have, call the clerk at 486-8636. Tomorrow, the local emergency planning committee meeting will be happening. That is happening at 1 p.m. tomorrow and virtually. To view that meeting, you need to go to the Kodiak Island Borough website. That is www.kodiakak.us. The Planning and Zoning Commission will be having a work session on Wednesday as well. That's also happening tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., also virtual. And the Assembly will be having their work session on Thursday at 6:30 p.m., all of these meetings are virtual and can be viewed at the Kodiak Island Borough website. The Kodiak History Museum's new exhibit, Making History Day by Day, Kodiak, Our Stories, and the COVID-19 Pandemic, is now on view at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Foyer. The exhibit is available at no cost to the public through February 23rd. It's a reflection on the COVID experience in Kodiak. The exhibit features art, stories, and photos, and more from people just like you. Kodiak History Museum will be hosting a drop-in activity at the auditorium foyer on February 12th. That's happening from 1 to 4 p.m., complete with activities and door prizes. That's Saturday, February 12th. Please contact the curator, Lynn Walker, at curator@kodiakhistorymuseum, all one word, .org, with any questions. The public library is remaining closed to the public through the month of February due to staff shortages and active COVID-19 cases in the community. Curbside service and home delivery is still available between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. Use their online catalog on the library's website to place holds on materials. Just call for questions at 486-8686.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.